Welcome to The Branching of the Road on Planet Waves FM, my semi-occasional program on A Course in Miracles. It's been a little while since I did this, since actually right before I got underway on the 2020 annual edition of Planet Waves 2020. Did I say that? It's been a long 2 years. 2022 annual edition of Planet Waves FM. I think the most recent one was the hybrid Tantra Studio Branching of the Road Miracle Hour. Anyway, I am back and here speaking to anyone curious about A Course in Miracles. I will link to many different prior editions, and I'm open to ideas and to questions about A Course in Miracles. Also, stories from the trail. Anyone who embarks on A Course in Miracles and takes it semi-seriously has some interesting things to tell about, things that have happened and all of that. Even though we're not supposed to use miracles as spectacles to induce belief, that's true. Occasionally, I will regale you with some thing that shouldn't have happened, but did happen, and it was really good that it did happen. Anyway, the theme of this particular kind of run of programs, however long it may go on for, is an assessment of the teachings of the Manual for Teachers. Of course, it's three volumes. The first is a big, thick, intimidating textbook. Well, this is when they were sold as separate. No, they were sold as one set, but delivered in separate volumes, which I recommend getting, old ones from the 80s. So the big, thick, imposing text is like 650 pages. And then there's a almost as big and almost imposing workbook. But the workbook, the pages are mostly blank for a lot of it because, it's like, there's a lot of white space, and some of the lessons are only, 20 words or a couple of hundred words. So, and then there's the Manual for Teachers. This is, it's like 60, 70 pages. It's real thin. It's written in very down-to-earth language. It's the third part of the book that came through, so it's volume three. And the presumption is that anyone who is a student is also a teacher, or as Course in Miracles says, everyone teaches and teaches all the time. Meaning that no matter what we're doing, we are teaching. So I've covered a bunch of the beginning of the Manual for Teachers, but here I think in this section, I'm reading off of a internet edition. So I don't really know where I am, but it's like probably around page 10 of the old-style hardcover Manual for Teachers. And by the way, I'd be happy to send one of those to anyone who initiates a monthly contribution to Planet Waves FM or not. But if you do, or not, to be fair, I have a stack of vintage copies of that from the very old days. These have to be from 1990 at latest. Anyway, here's where we get into the heart of the matter on the Manual for Teachers. What are the characteristics of God's teachers? So the teacher's manual is written in Q&A format, and that's a Q, and then it gives an A. The surface traits of God's teachers are not all alike. They do not look alike to the body's eyes. They come from vastly different backgrounds. Their experiences of the world vary greatly, and their superficial personalities are quite distinct. Nor at the beginning stages of their functioning as teachers of God's have they as yet acquired the deeper characteristics that will establish them as what they are. God gives special gifts to all his teachers, because they have a special role in his plan for the atonement. Their specialness is, of course, only temporary, set in times as a means of leading out of time. These special gifts born in the holy relationship toward which the teaching-learning situation is geared become characteristics of all teachers of God who have advanced in their own learning. In this respect, they are all alike. All differences among the sons of God, which is the language the Course uses, are temporary. Nevertheless, in time, it can be said that the advanced teachers of God have the following characteristics. I'll link to this also. It because of my workload these days, it takes me a while to do some of this tech work. And if I ever promise something that that I don't do, after a couple of days, just drop me an email and I will perk up and do it. Okay, so the characteristics of God's teachers. Number one, trust. This is the foundation on which their ability to fulfill their function rests. Perception is the result of learning. In fact, perception is learning because cause and effect are never separated. The teachers of God have trust in the world because they have learned it is not governed by the laws the world made up. It is governed by the power that is in them, but not of them. It is this power that keeps all things safe. It is through this power that the teachers of God look on a forgiven world. When this power has once been experienced, it is impossible to trust one's own petty strength again. Well, I wish that was true, but maybe I haven't experienced the power that it's talking about when I thought I did. So let's leave that an open question. Who would attempt to fly with the tiny wings of a sparrow when the mighty power of an eagle has been given him? And who would place his faith in the shabby offerings of the ego when the gifts of God are laid before him? What is it that induces them to make the shift? Question mark. Next section. A. Get ready. Get ready for this one. It goes on for a while. Development of trust. Now, no one, I imagine everyone who reads this, you know, basically thinks about it for a long time. It's kind of, you can't unread this. So here we go. First, they must go through what is called a period of undoing. This need not be painful, but it is usually so experienced. It seems as if things are being taken away, and it is not really understood that their lack of value is merely being recognized. That is to say, it says, it seems like things are being taken away, but really what's going on is that you're recognizing their lack of value. How can lack of value be perceived unless the perceiver is in a position where he must see things in a different light? He is not yet at a point where he can make the shift entirely voluntarily. Hold on, I think I lost my place. Let's try that again. How can lack of value be experienced unless the perceiver is in a position where he must see things in a different light? He is not yet at a point at which he can make the shift entirely internally, and so the plan will sometimes call for changes in what seem like external circumstances. These changes are always helpful. When the teacher of God has learned that much, he goes on to the second stage. So the first stage is realizing that the change is helpful, this kind of change. Next, the teacher of God must go through a, quote, period of sorting out. This is always somewhat difficult because having learned that the changes in his life are always helpful, he must now decide all things on the basis of whether they increase the helpfulness or hamper it. Pause. This is a very important value to learn. It is the value of asking, does this help or does this hurt? Does this add or does this take away something of value? He may find that many, if not most, things he valued before will merely hinder his ability to transfer what he has learned to new situations as they arise. Because he's valued what is really valueless, he will not generalize the lesson of fear, of loss, and sacrifice. Let's read that again. He will find that many, if not most, things he valued before will merely hinder his ability to transfer what he has learned to new situations as they arise. Because he has valued what is really valueless, he will not generalize the lesson for fear of loss and sacrifice. It takes great learning to understand that all things, events, encounters, and circumstances are helpful. It is only to the extent to which they are helpful that any degree of reality should be accorded them in this world of illusion. The word value can apply to nothing else. All right, third stage the teacher of God must go through can be called the period of relinquishment. If this is interpreted as giving up the desirable, he will engender tremendous conflict. Few teachers of God escape this distress entirely. There is, however, no point in sorting out the valuable from what is valueless unless the next obvious step is taken. Therefore, the period of overlap is apt to be one in which the teacher of God feels called upon to sacrifice his own best interests on behalf of truth. He has not realized yet how wholly impossible such a demand would be. He can learn this only as he actually does give up the valueless. Therefore, he learns that where he anticipated grief, he finds a happy lightheartedness instead. Where he thought something was asked of him, he finds a gift bestowed on him. Pause. It's cool when that happens. Now comes a period of settling down. This is a quiet time in which the teacher of God rests a while in reasonable peace. Now he consolidates his learning. He begins to see the transfer value of what he has learned. By the way, this transfer value is pretty much everything. The ability to move what is learned in one situation into another situation. Its potential is literally staggering, and the teacher of God is now at the point in his progress at which he sees in it his whole way out. Quote, give up what you do not want and keep what you do. Unquote. How simple is the obvious? And how easy to do? The teacher of God needs this period of respite, or respite. How do you pronounce that? I guess I would say respite. He has not yet come as far as he thinks, and when he's ready to go on, he goes with mighty companions beside him. Now he rests a while and gathers them before going on. He will not go on from here alone. The next stage is indeed a period of unsettling. Now must the teacher of God understand that he did not really know what is valuable and what is valueless. All that he really learned so far was what he did not want the valueless and did want the valuable. Yet his own sorting out was meaningless in teaching him the difference. this part always throws me. The idea of sacrifice, so central to his own thought system, has made it impossible for him to judge. He thought he learned willingness, and now he sees he does not know what willingness is for. Now he must attain a state that may remain impossible to reach for a long, long time. He must learn to lay all judgment aside and ask for what he really wants in every circumstance. Were not each step in this direction so heavily reinforced, it would be hard indeed. Finally, there is a period of achievement. And it is here that learning is consolidated. Now what was seen as merely shadows become solid gains to be counted on in all emergencies, quote-unquote emergencies, as well as in tranquil times. Indeed, the tranquility is their result, the outcome of honest learning, consistency, and thought, and full transfer. Let's read that again. Now what was seen as merely shadows before become solid gains to be counted on in all emergencies, as well as in tranquil times. Indeed, the tranquility is their result, the outcome of honest learning, consistency of thought, and of full transfer. So those are the results that bring tranquility. And they are the outcome of honest learning, consistency of thought, and full transfer. This is the stage of real peace. For here is heaven's state fully reflected. From here, the way to heaven is open and easy. In fact, it is here. Who would go anywhere if peace of mind is already complete? And who would seek to change tranquility for something more desirable? What could be more desirable than this? So this essay, A, Development of Trust, which enumerates the stages of growth, the approximate stages of growth. And I have to say, I really studied this when I first got going with the course in, 86, 87, 88. Those were the years I was, really doing daily study, much of it living at Miracle Manor. This is really intense, to think, okay, the way ahead. And I started the course way younger than most people. Most people start fairly well-evolved adults. I started in 86, 3 days after my 22nd birthday. So you're looking ahead at this thinking, what is all this going to be about? And that's a good question. Setting that part aside for a second, I think something is worth mentioning, which is that spiritual paths require some structure. Now, the structure can often be abused by the structuring agent of some kind. People get involved in all manner of churches and organizations and cults because they want that structure, and they seem to need some external set of references by which to guide themselves. But those can easily become enslaving, and so it is necessary to have just enough of that structure and then to not be a slave to that structure. There need, I think, to be some focused ideas, particularly in our somewhat anarchist times, where literacy has basically collapsed, where our ability to see things in context as a culture is all but gone. I mean, with COVID, one thing we're struggling with is a massive lack of context. And this is very problematic, to be living without the ability to frame our experiences. The other problem with external structure is that it is so often presented as some kind of a moralistic structure. And, as moralistic as A Course in Miracles gets, and I think that this is what distinguishes it from most world religions, and in that I would include more of the popular forms of Taoism and Buddhism rather than the more esoteric levels, is this. So, for example, period of sorting out is somewhat difficult because having learned that changes in life are helpful, he must now decide all things on the basis of whether they increase the helpfulness or hamper it. That's not saying do or don't do anything. It's saying here's a basis for evaluation. Does it help or does it not help? That's about as far from moralism as you can get, and it leaves you asking the question and then basically waiting for or seeking the answer, and not in general terms. This thing. So there's a teaching at some point along the way that says, when should teacher intervene? When do you intervene? And the teaching given is if you determine that your actions will not harm anyone, then you may intervene. So what this does is, instead of having people jump in as rescuers or risk their lives in some way, which would be kind of qualify as being a rescuer, you first make an assessment. Will this help the assessment is, will this hurt anyone? So for example, if someone comes to me seeking a homeopathic remedy, that's the question I ask. I do this with every time I'm called into service in some way. Will this harm or will this help? So I do a risk assessment, and I determine, and if I get back, and remember that you're doing this sorting out of each individual question with the guidance of your inner teacher. If I get that this is not going to hurt anyone, then I will do it. This is one reason, by the way, why I lean so conservative in my astrological readings in terms of not going off any deep ends, but also not working when I am compromised. So if you notice I am lightening my workload, for example, it is so that I don't get hurt or don't hurt you, because I am exceeding my patience, my strength, my abilities, or whatever. So this question, will this harm anyone, is a very important assessment to make before you help, and that anyone includes you. Okay, so we were talking about having a structure for spiritual training prior to that, and the risk being that many structures end up becoming moralistic structures. Moralistic structures almost always harm people. And so my point here is that for the course to say, make an assessment, what harms, what helps, is anything but a moralistic structure. You may be looking at a nice pile of cocaine on the table and think, well, it would be nice to try that. And then you could say, will this harm or will this help? Well, if your inner teacher says, no, this is perfectly harmless, then, chow down. It's very unlikely you would hear that, but even given risky activities, well, particularly given risky activities, that's a good question to ask. Will this harm or will this help? And so it's imposing, not even imposing, it's proposing a very small and efficient tool for making evaluations. And this seems to be the theme that runs through all of Part A, Development of Trust. So we are in now, we're a third of the way into the characteristics of God teachers. The first one is trust, and then there's a subsection, the development of trust. Let's look at one more. Part two, honesty. Now, if I recall, this is also not something that you're expecting. So I haven't read this in a while. Two, honesty. All other traits of God's teachers rest on trust. Once that has been achieved, the others cannot fail to follow. Only the trusting can afford honesty, for only they see its value. So, by the way, when people are mistrustful and dishonest, you got to pay attention to that. They're telling you the most important thing about them. And those who are dishonest and mistrusting are going to have other issues, and you need to pay attention to that. Continuing. Honesty does not apply only to what you say. The term actually means consistency. There is nothing that you say that contradicts what you think or do. No thought opposes any other thought. No act belies your word. No word lacks agreement with another. Such are the truly honest. At no level are they in conflict with themselves. Therefore, it is impossible for them to be in conflict with anyone or anything. Now, this is pausing. This is a tall order, and this is speaking in seeming absolute. So I would take this as a metric, as a guide rule, right? So you're going to be working out conflict for a while, but the working out of conflict changes over time. And so this is why, you know, ongoing cultivation of your growth and applying every situation to your growth are crucial. So let's read this part again. Part 2, honesty. All other traits of God's teachers rest on trust. Once that has been achieved, the others cannot fail to follow. Only the trusting can afford honesty, for only they can see its value. Honesty does not apply only to what you say. The term actually means consistency. There is nothing you say that contradicts what you think or do. No thought opposes any other thought. No act belies your word. And no word lacks agreement with any other, no matter how often you pound the Bible or call people wicked sinners or point your finger or whatever. Right? That's not honest. That's not trusting. That's not consistent. And the thing that burns us up, this is me rambling, the thing that burns us up about people who claim to be teachers of God, who then end up, you know, having their photograph with a prostitute published. Well, the problem is not hanging out with the prostitute. I happen to love hanging out with sex workers. I'll do it in any country of the world. However, the problem is saying it's a bad thing and then doing it. That is called hypocrisy. And so I think this honesty teaching is essentially a teaching against hypocrisy. Now, in my journalism life, I often say hypocrisy is a drug. It's somewhat based on this. This is kind of the satirical version of this teaching. Hypocrisy is a drug because a lot of people really seem to get off on it. They seem to love to laugh at people who believe their lies, and then they go and do something else. Now, you know, that too needs to be forgiven, but that does not need to be something that you accept or imbibe, certainly not in yourself. Okay, the second paragraph of this teaching reads thus, The peace of mind which the advanced teachers of God experience is largely due to their perfect honesty. Period. Pause. Yeah, this helps a lot. One who tells the truth does not need to worry about their lies being found out. Most anxiety has some root in the fear of one's lies being found out. And so it is certainly a state of mind amenable to peace of mind to be honest. Continuing, it is only the wish to deceive that makes for war. Oh, this comports with Lao Tzu that deception is essential. Deception is essential to war. No one at one with himself can even conceive of conflict. Conflict is the inevitable result of self-deception, and self-deception is dishonesty. God, I can see a lot of my horoscope writing is based on this. I haven't read this in years. But I say it a lot, and I mean it when I say it. So I'm not quoting the book. I'm going from essentially having proven all this to be true sufficiently in my own life, and then writing too many articles about liars. Continuing, there is no challenge to a teacher of God. Challenge implies doubt, and the trust on which God's teachers rest secure makes doubt impossible. God, wouldn't that be nice? Therefore, they can only succeed. Oh, that'd be even better. In this and all things, they are honest. They can only succeed because they never do their will alone. They choose for all mankind, for all the world and all things in it, for all the unchanging and unchangeable beyond appearances, and for the child of God and his creator. How could they not succeed? They choose in perfect honesty, sure of their choice as of themselves. And there you have that. Let's leave a little for next time. Love to hear your thoughts about any of this and any of your, stories from the path, stories from the road. Let's go out with a little bit of Vision Quest featuring Jelko. And then, though I have not made up the set list for tomorrow night, we're going to end with some additional music from the Woodstock Festival from August 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, actually 15, 16, 17, 18. That's correct. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 1969, in memory of Michael Lang, who left this world on, I believe, on January 7 or 8. And there you have it. All right. Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you're listening on YouTube or on Podbean or Apple, we're going to load this up onto those. Forget I said all those things, and you can just go to planetwaves.fm. This particular segment of this particular edition of The Branching of the Road is from the January 14, 2022 edition of Planet Waves FM. It'll also be on the Branching of the Road special page on the Planet Waves FM website. And for now, I thank you and bid you good night. Bye for now.